Wow. My name is Rose, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Rose.
My sobriety date is January 12th, 2001, and I think I'll just listen tonight. It sounded really funny in the shower. I can't even begin to explain to you how full my heart is right now. Never in a million years did I think I'd be able to be sober for one day. And here I am at an international women's conference for Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I am a miracle, as are all of you. This is just, it's beyond my wildest dreams. I should mention, I do have a home group. I do have a sponsor, and I do work the steps to the best of my ability. I want to thank Ann for asking me to speak tonight. It seemed like no big deal 2 years ago when she asked me. Got to be a big deal about an hour ago when I wanted to vomit and pee my pants all at the same time. But here I am, and AA has taught me to feel the fear and just do it anyway. And I am afraid, but I'm just going to do what I'm told to do, and that's to share my experience, my strength, and my hope with you. I love AA, and that's something I never thought I'd be able to say. Everything that's good in my life today is because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never thought that was possible. At the end of my drinking, I just wanted to die, and now I don't. And that's a miracle. That's one of the many gifts that this program has bestowed on me. I'm always curious as to why someone asked me to speak, because I'm not especially funny, and I never seem to have anything very profound to say. But I can assure you this, I will honestly tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I am truly grateful to be given the privilege to share my experience, my strength, and my hope with you. I am 46 years old. I am originally from New Jersey. I am, woohoo! All right! I am from a Roman Catholic Irish family, which may surprise some of you. I'm the third out of four children, and I think I was born depressed. I really do. I think I just was never a happy child. I don't think my skin ever fit. I don't think I ever felt comfortable. I don't think drinking led me to that place. I think I was in that place long before I ever picked up the drink. I think drink just made my life manageable and bearable for a very long time. I was painfully shy as a child. I mean painfully shy. I was overweight. I had bright red hair before red hair was fashionable. I was awkward, you know. I was just that kid. I had friends and that kind of stuff, but I just never was the popular girl. I wasn't the cheerleader. I just was just awkward. And I followed my two brothers in school, and my brothers were everything that I wasn't. They were athletic, and they were popular, and they were smart. And I was just this wallflower in the background, but I always felt safe at home. You know, I was the only girl up until I was 9 years old. I was the baby, and I was kind of felt safe at home. And when I was 9, my parents had another child. They had my little sister. And when she was born, I just kind of disappeared. You know, I just kind of faded into the woodwork, and I started becoming more of a parent to her than a young person. And I assumed responsibilities at a very young age. I had two paper routes at 9 years old, and I was just a go-getter, but I never really had a happy childhood. I remember that alcohol was always a part of our growing up life. Coming from an Irish Catholic family, we drank. I mean, if you went to a wedding, you drank. If there was a funeral, you drank. I mean, that's what we did. We drank. And we always, at least I did, equated alcohol to social events. I mean, my parents would have a couple of drinks, my aunts and uncles would have a couple of drinks, and they'd loosen up, and they'd start to sing, and everything was good. It was good times. And I remember being a small child and tasting alcohol. I remember tasting whiskey and beer that was left on the tables, and I never liked it. I never liked the taste of alcohol. And I still, to this day, don't like the taste of alcohol. What I liked is the effect that it gave me. Actually, it was the effect that it didn't give me. The first time I ever got drunk, I was 14 years old. And it was before a high school dance. I wanted to fit in. I was desperate to fit in somehow, some way. And that's what the kids did, you know. You smoked cigarettes down by the wall and you drank beer. So I convinced my oldest brother to buy me a six-pack of beer. And he said, Rose, I don't think that's a good idea. And I said, why? You do it. That's what everybody does, right? And I nagged him enough and bugged him enough until he did. He broke down and he bought me that six-pack of beer. And I remember drinking it, three beers. And what I remember is after I drank those beers, I didn't feel fat anymore. I didn't feel afraid anymore. And I didn't feel like I wasn't good enough or smart enough or pretty enough or anything enough. I didn't feel anything. And that was it. I had found my solution. That was the solution to my skin not fitting. That was the solution to all of my problems. And I truly believe for me that from that moment on, anytime I drank to get drunk. I never, ever was a social drinker. I drank with an absolute mission. It wasn't to feel good. It was to forget. It was to be completely annihilated. I never knew how to properly drink. There was a lot of bad signs all throughout my early drinking that it probably wasn't a good idea. By the age of 15, I had my first bout with alcohol poisoning, and I almost died. I had to be rushed to the hospital. I had to have my heart started again. And most kids might have thought, you know, I'm not really doing this really well. It's probably not a good idea, but I just figured out I probably needed to do it a little differently. Maybe I shouldn't drink the whole bottle of vodka straight. Maybe I should slow down. But I knew I wasn't going to give it up. It was too important to me. I lived to drink. Drinking was everything to me. By the time I was 16, I was hanging out in bars. I always looked older than I was, and I used that to my advantage. I made friends with the bouncers and the bartenders, and I hung out in bars after school. I always managed, though, to keep the grades up for my parents and to do those things that I was supposed to do, but I always drank. By the time I was 17 years old, my father sat me down, and he said, Rose, you have all the earmarks of being an alcoholic. And my father was a bartender by trade. And if he knew an alcoholic, he certainly saw one in his daughter. And I knew my dad was right. I remember sitting across the dining room table from him and thinking, you probably got a point. But I knew I was never going to stop drinking. I knew I just had to hide it better, do it better, become sneakier. But I wasn't going to give it up because that was my answer to everything. I truly believe that drinking kept me from killing myself through most of my life because it just numbed all those feelings that I had. And I had no other coping skill. Drinking was the only coping skill that I had, and I used it. By the time I was 18 and graduated from high school, I decided to try college. I enrolled in a local community college in my area, and I realized this wasn't for me. I didn't want to learn anymore. I didn't want to go to school anymore. I wanted to drink. I wanted to go out, and I wanted to go to the bars, and I wanted to play pool. I never played pool, by the way. I think I did, but I never did. And I wanted to do that, so that I dropped out of school, and I started working. And that gave me the money that I loved. Among other things, that I can become addicted to air, by the way. I became addicted to working. I would work 7 days a week, 20 hours a day, because I loved money. And money gave me the ability to drink and to live a lifestyle that I liked. And fortunately for me, I was able to get in on a very ground level with a very big company, and I started to work very, very hard, and I started to make lots and lots of money. It's really easy when you have money to hide how bad your life is. When you can wear the right clothes and write the check and bail people out and buy the insurance gifts that pay people off for the next time you screw up, and the apology gifts to say I'm sorry because you don't remember what you did. It makes your life a little more bearable. It makes you more tolerable. But by the time I was 20 years old, not only had I already become an everyday drinker, I was a blackout drinker. Every time I drank, I blacked out. And it was far too embarrassing for me to drink socially anymore. Around the same time, I met a man. Another alcoholic, like myself. And I think that's what attracted me to him, is that he drank like I did. I didn't feel like I didn't fit in with him. I didn't date him. We didn't dance. We didn't go to the movies. We didn't go to dinner. We just drank. And unfortunately, I spent the next 13 years of my life with this man. About 2 or 3 years into our relationship, both of our parents could see how absolutely sick and toxic and dangerous this relationship was, and they tried to break us up, but, you know, we were in love, and that wasn't going to happen. And we ended up staying together, and about 5 years into the relationship, my parents decided to move to Florida. And I was 25 years old. I was living at home, paying $20 a week rent. And they threw me out on the street, and I decided to move in with this man. And I must say, I'd already been an everyday drinker, but when I moved in with this man, the amount of alcohol that I started to drink was just unbelievable. I didn't have to hide anything anymore. I didn't have to come home and look at mom and dad anymore. I had no restraints. My boundaries were gone. And I started drinking about 1.75 liters of whiskey every day. Around the same time that I moved in with him, he decided to stop working. And that's okay with me, because I'm the queen of settling. I settle for anything, you know. I have shortchanged myself my entire life, and I settled for it. He also started to become physically abusive, sexually abusive, psychologically abusive. Any type of abusive you can imagine, this man was. And I was so sick myself that I couldn't see clear of this relationship. I thought I was stuck. I was so afraid that when he said he would kill me, that he meant it. I was so afraid that when he said he would hurt my family, that he really would, and I stayed there. I stayed there for a very long time, and my drinking just progressed and progressed. Fortunately, though, I was still good at what I did. I don't know how I managed to keep this job, but I think as much of an alcoholic as I am, I'm a workaholic, and I threw everything I had into this job, and I kept making more and more money, and I got the opportunity to travel, and I had a good life from the outside looking in. But on the inside, my life was just spiraling right into the toilet. And I knew I had to get away from him because he was the problem. You see, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm good with all that. It was never the whole powerless over alcohol thing. I got that. I knew I was. I just never could see that my life was unmanageable. Well, he decided to try and get sober, and he had been to many, many rehabs, many, many detoxes, and after he came out of this one particular rehab, he asked me if I would go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with him. And I said, okay, I'll go, you know, because I'm going to be supportive and help him because he's the one with the problem. And if he'd get himself sober, then my life would just be dandy and everything would be good. And so I went to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with him, and I will never forget it. It was in a hospital, and it was a speaker meeting. And I walked in, and there was a woman sharing by the name of Debbie B. And from the moment she opened her mouth and started to share her story, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. She was telling my story. She was telling how she had never felt like she was a part of anything, that she had never felt like she was good enough, that she had always sold herself short. All that emotional stuff that had been inside of me, she was putting out there in front of this room full of people. And I didn't know at that time that that was my first connection with another alcoholic. After the meeting, probably because I was weeping like a baby, she approached me and she said, you don't have to live like this anymore. There's a better way. And she put her hand out there. She put the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous out there and she tried to help me. She became my sponsor and she started making suggestions. One of the suggestions was, you should stop drinking, Rose. And I had a hard time with that one. I'd go to meetings drunk. I'd go home from the meetings and get drunk, and she tried so hard. She loved me with her whole heart, and she eventually convinced me I should go to rehab, and I did. I went away for a 28-day program to a very exclusive rehab in New Jersey, and I think I got the chip at the end that says most likely never to drink again and blah, 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 and I got out, and I didn't do what I was told. You know, I didn't go to meetings the way I was supposed to. I didn't do the things that my sponsor suggested. And within 2 months, I was drinking again, and so was the man that I was with. The abuse started again, and I knew that I had to walk away from him. I knew that the only chance I had was to get rid of this man. And I was almost ready to do it. I almost found the strength. And right about that time, he fell down a flight of stairs and he broke his neck. and now he was partially paralyzed. And what kind of a woman would walk away from a man when he's partially paralyzed? You know, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it, and I stayed with him. I stayed with him for the next 2 years. And over the next 2 years, he continued to drink, because of course I bought it for him. And the reason I bought it for him, because it was the easier, softer way, was to give him alcohol so that he wouldn't become as violent as he normally would. But those bouts of violence would still erupt, and there were nights where I'm ashamed to say that I would go to the drugstore and I would buy boxes of sleeping pills and I would crush them. And I'd put them in his drink and I'd mix them up, praying to God that he would just pass out. I didn't realize at the time that I probably could have killed him. But I'm ashamed to say that, but it is true, I did do that. And eventually, my mother came up from Florida to visit me. And my parents didn't realize that I'd relapsed. I allowed them to believe that I'd still been sober from the rehab. So it's kind of easy to do when your parents live out of state and your family lives out of state. You just don't call them when you're drunk. You know what I mean? You just, and my mother says now she knows. I don't know if she knew. But I just wouldn't dial her number. Now, I was good at dialing the phone when I was drunk, but I just wouldn't call Florida. So they were under the impression that I was still sober and that I was just in this horrible relationship. They knew that there was domestic violence. They didn't know the extent of it. The reason they knew is because my neighbors would call the police, and it would be in the newspaper, and my brothers would read it, and they would call my parents and let them know. And any time they asked me, I would deny it. But there's something about a mother's ability to look inside her child's soul. And my mother did that on this visit, and she looked at me and she said, "You have got to get away from him." And I don't think I broke up with this man. I think my mother did. I really don't. I mean, she said it's over, and I walked away, and that was it. And I really thought, I really believed that my life was going to magically get better because he was no longer in my life. I was naive enough to think if I took him out of the equation that I was going to find true happiness. And then he was gone. And I was just as sad. And I was just as lonely. And I was drinking just as much as I'd ever had before. The only thing I didn't have anymore was the ability to blame him for my life. And I knew it was my drinking. I knew that's what it was, but I didn't know how to stop. I didn't want any part of AA. I couldn't go back there. I thought they were all fruitcakes. All they want to do is touch you and kiss you and love you, and I didn't want any of that. I didn't want you to touch me. Please don't touch me. So I just drank more, and my loneliness got worse and worse and worse. And eventually I started hanging around with some younger people at my office, and I started doing things that I hadn't done in years. I was not very social because I can't be a social alcoholic the way I'm an alcoholic because I'm a pig. So they didn't know that side of me, and I would do little tiny things, like I'd go to an afternoon movie maybe, or I'd maybe go on a little shopping trip with some friends, because I was pretty much a recluse. I was very much of a hermit, but I was so lonely I just couldn't stand myself anymore. And eventually, one night, one of these girls that I was hanging around said, "Rose, we're going out for a couple of drinks after work. Why don't you go?" And I said, "Well, I don't do that, you know." "No, I don't think so." And she said, "No, really." And I was so lonely, and I was so sick of myself that I decided to go, which was really odd. And it was November 25th, 1998. It was the night before Thanksgiving. And I didn't know this at the time. I was 33 at this time, that the night before Thanksgiving is a huge night out in the bars. All the kids are there, big party night. Well, I didn't know that. I'm an old fart who drinks at home alone. You know what I mean? I didn't know. So, of course, I'd had a couple of drinks before I left my house, and I went and I met my friends at the bar. I don't like bars. I really don't. I got to tell you. First of all, it's so hard to get a drink. I'm not kidding. You got to push and shove, and I don't like people touching me. And then you get up there, and they give you these sissy little drinks that are this big. Who are you kidding? I drink out of 20-ounce solo cups. It's all whiskey. I tease myself with a little 7-Up on the top, and it's one sip out of a straw. And now I'm drinking these sissy little drinks, and I was just having a horrible time. I was having a horrible time because I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink. And I didn't want to stay anymore, but I tried to be social because I hated myself so much. And I stayed there for a couple of hours, and I said, "You know what, I'm going to head home. I've had enough." And I said goodbye to my friends, and never in a million years did I think that I was drunk. Never for a second did I think that I shouldn't put the key in the ignition and drive home. I was a professional drinker. This is nothing. I've had a couple of drinks. I'm good. And I did exactly that. I put the key in the ignition of my car and I started to drive home. And I lived 18 miles from where this bar was located. And I lived in a very rural part of northwest New Jersey. And there's no street lights, there's no sidewalks, a lot of farms. And I was almost home. I think it was about 17.3 miles. I was literally around the corner from my apartment. And I dropped my cigarette. And I bent over to pick it up. And I hit something. And I was absolutely convinced that I hit a deer. And I was absolutely certain that there was no way I was going to stop. Because the police department was 100 yards up on the left-hand side. I knew I had been drinking, even though I didn't think I was drunk. I was quite certain the police would think I was drunk. And I decided to continue on home, and I did that. I carried on. I made a turn. I parked my car, and I went inside. And it was raining. It was a night where it was torrentially raining. And when I got inside, I called a friend. I was talking to a friend of mine, actually, on the computer, and I said, you know, I hit a deer on the way home. It was two streets up. And my windshield shattered, and it's raining, and my car's going to get damaged. And he said, I have a tarp in the garage, Rose. I'll come over, and I'll help you. And he did. About 10 minutes later, I saw him pull in, and I walked out to the car with him. And when we went to cover the windshield, on the passenger side was a tuft of hair and a chunk of human skin. And I panicked. I just panicked. And I said, please take me back. I literally was around the corner. I mean, you always hear that, you know, these horrible accidents or accidents in general happen just so close to where you live, and it did. I mean, as soon as we turned the corner, I could see at the end of the street there was police cars and there was an ambulance. And I just froze. And I knew that I had this man with me, and I couldn't get him in trouble, so I said, please take me home. Because at this point now I know it's not a deer. They don't call an ambulance for a deer. And he did. He drove me home, and I got out of my car, and I went inside, and I waited. I didn't hide my car. I didn't run. I just waited. And being the good alcoholic that I am, I drank, and I drank, and I drank. Eventually, a couple hours later, there was a knock on my door, and it was the police, and they said, Miss Eshman, it appears as though there's been an accident, and your car was involved. We need to bring you in for questioning. And they did. And after 2.5 hours, they told me that I'd struck and killed a man who was walking in the road. And I didn't see him, and I didn't stop. I was bailed out of the police department that night, and it was actually early the next morning, and I went home, and I absolutely knew my life was never going to be the same again. I absolutely knew that I would never, ever be able to get over what I had done. That I had taken someone's life. I couldn't imagine how my life had gotten to this point. How could it have gotten so bad? But there were so many signs. I knew for a long time I was out of control. I just didn't know how to stop. And now this has happened, and I knew whatever was going to happen was too much for me. I'm not going to be able to get through this. And I went on a mission to kill myself. I continued to drink. I continued to do anything to numb my pain. And my family convinced me of two things. They convinced me that I needed to get psychiatric treatment and I needed to get an attorney. And I did both those things. I got an attorney and I checked myself into a psychiatric ward. After a few, I think it was almost 2 weeks, they released me and they said, you know what, Rose, you're not safe to go home by yourself. And they were right, because I was still at that suicidal point where the only way out was death. I couldn't get over what I had done. I used to drive to the scene of this accident, and I just used to look and not ever think I could ever get over being responsible for taking someone else's life. And my life just kept getting worse. I kept drinking. I kept trying to commit suicide. Eventually, I had to leave my job. I couldn't do the simple things in life that I used to be able to do. I couldn't shower. I couldn't put a full sentence together. I couldn't put a noun before a verb. I just wanted to die. I failed to mention that I had an affair with my counselor at this... I'm such an alcoholic. At this crisis house that they made me stay in. And he tried to help me. He really did. And it took him a long time to realize that I was as sick as I was. I think he's got that rescuer thing where he likes to rescue women. And he tried to help me, and it didn't work. And eventually he told me, Rose, if you drink one more time, you got to go. One more time, and I'm putting you on a plane to Florida. So you know what that means. He goes to work, I go to the liquor store. Because nobody's going to tell me what to do. And I was in so much pain that alcohol was my only, it was my only answer. I couldn't stand my being in my own skin. I couldn't stand who I was. And true to his words, he went to work, I went to the liquor store, and he put me on a plane to Florida the next day. This whole time, I was awaiting trial, because I decided to take my case to trial. And the reason I did that was really, really simple. I knew I was guilty. It wasn't about guilt or innocence, because I did it. It was really simple. I drank, I drove, I killed somebody. But I thought if I could go into a courtroom and I could look at this man's family and I could let them see that I wasn't a monster and that I didn't mean it and it was just a really bad mistake, that somehow it would take away the sickness in my soul, that somehow it would alleviate some of this pain that I was feeling. And that's the only reason I decided to do this. But it took 2.5 years to get my case to trial. So I came down to Florida at the age of 36 while I was waiting for all this to happen, and I moved in with my parents. And God love my parents. They did everything possible to try and help me, everything possible to try and save me, but I was just on a mission. My father was all over me. I couldn't go for a walk for more than 5 minutes, and my father was right behind me because he knew. He knew I was looking for a liquor store. Sometimes I found it. One of the hardest things I ever experienced was him pouring a full bottle of whiskey down the drain while I watched it. Because when you want to die, and somebody's taking your only friend and pouring it down the drain, I can't even explain what that feels like. Around this time, my brother-in-law had found recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came to my parents' house for dinner. And he said to me, Rose, I'm going to a meeting of AA tonight. Would you like to go? I have never hated anybody in my life like I hated him at that moment. How dare you? And I remember my father looking over his glasses and saying, baby, I don't think you have a choice. And so I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't pick my head up. And I couldn't look anybody in the eye. It took everything in me to say, my name is Rose and I am an alcoholic. And I just kept going. Every single night for months, he took me to a meeting. And eventually, my head started to clear a little bit. And eventually, I started to realize, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can get through this. And unfortunately, I made a decision to get back involved with that man in New Jersey who kindly asked me to leave his home. And I started making trips back and forth. And on one of those trips, I got a phone call from my sister that said my father was very ill and please come home. And I did. And within a month, my father died. But I was sober. And I got to tell him I loved him. And I got to say I was sorry for anything I'd ever done to hurt him or to steal his joy. But after my father died and I got my mother, you know, organized and settled, I decided to go back to New Jersey and be with this man because 3 months later I was going to face trial, and I knew that. So I got on a plane, and I don't think my feet were on the ground in New Jersey when I started to drink again. I also realized around this time that I was pregnant. It's a hard thing to admit, but I knew it. I knew it in my heart. I knew it in my soul. And I kept drinking. I couldn't stop. And eventually he did it again. He said, Rose, I can't take this. And he put me on another plane and he sent me back to Florida. My sister picked me up at the airport with my sponsor. And I was sitting in the lounge at Tampa Airport with two very large drinks. And she said to me, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm drunk." And she said, "I know." And she took me home. And from that day on, every single day for the next 3 months, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every single night, I got drunk after the meeting. I cannot tell you the torture it is to be a drunk and attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't share because you're a liar. You can't look anybody in the eye because you're a liar. And you don't want to get too close because you probably still smell. So it was the longest 3 months of my life. Eventually, on January 11th, 2001, I boarded a plane and I came back to New Jersey and I stood trial. My trial lasted for 3.5 weeks. And at the end of that trial, I was found guilty of 3 charges. I was found guilty of death by auto, leaving the scene of an accident, and possession of less than 50 milligrams of paraphernalia and CDS. They immediately took me to the county jail. I had to wait to be sentenced. I remember calling my mom from the county jail and saying, "Please get me out, please get me out, please get me out," because she could have put $50,000 cash down and gotten me out, and I couldn't understand why she didn't have it in her back pocket. And she kept saying, "I'm not doing it, Rosellen," and I'd hang up the phone and I'd call her 50 times over and over, "Get me out, get me out." But she knew. She knew if she got me out, I'd find a way to do it. All those attempts before, and there was about 4 suicide attempts, wouldn't have compared to the final act because I would have done it. And she came to see me in the county jail and she looked at me and she said, "I love you, but I'm not getting you out of jail." And she let me sit there until the day I was sentenced, which was in June of 2001. And I was sentenced to 12 years and 30 days in the state facility. 8 days later, I was shipped off to the only female prison in the state of New Jersey. And I remember walking in and hearing those big metal bars shut behind me, thinking, "I'm never going to make it. I'm not like these people. I'm not like them. But I am like them." All I did was face a consequence for a choice I made. That was the consequence of the choice I made. I've never blamed God or man for where my life has gone. I knew I've only been asked to pay the consequence of the choice I made, but I didn't think I would be able to survive it. For the first 3 years of my sentence, I was in maximum security because I'm a violent offender in New Jersey. In New Jersey, your car becomes your weapon. So I had to serve the first 3 years of my sentence in maximum security. And I thought, "Oh, God, I'll never survive." But I did. And then I thought to myself, "I can't wait to get out and drink," because I planned it. I really planned it. I knew exactly what I was going to do. I knew exactly where I was going to buy it. I knew exactly where I was going to hide it. And that's how I spent the first 3 years in prison, angry and still suicidal and still hating everybody around me. And eventually, after 3 years, I was given an opportunity for a lower classification, and I went to what they call minimum security. And when I got to the minimum security part of the prison, there was a program. It was called Puppies Behind Bars. And it's a program where inmates raise dogs for law enforcement, which I still think is a riot. You're going to take a convicted felon and let them raise a dog for a cop? Really? Okay, I'm in. So, really, right? So what I knew is this, that I hadn't seen anything. I'd seen concrete and dirt and barbed wires. And when I got to this other part of the prison, I saw trees, and I saw a highway, and I saw cars. And there was this program with dogs. And I hadn't seen a dog in years. So I got involved in this program, and I started working with dogs, and I realized, oh, my God, I love it. I love it. And eventually, after about 4 months, they handed me my own dog to raise. It was an 8-week-old black Labrador retriever named Sandy. And I loved her. They put this little dog in my hands. And it was the first time I have allowed myself to feel anything in years. I have built up these incredible walls around me. And inside those walls is everything that's bad. All the fear, all the pain, all the loneliness, the anger, the depression. It's all in there with me. And this dog just started to lower those walls. And I remember one night sitting in my room with her and looking at her, and she just loved me. She didn't care who I was. She didn't care what I did. She didn't care I was in prison. She didn't care what I smelled like. She loved me. And I thought to myself, oh my God, maybe there's hope for me. Maybe I have a chance. And one of my friends in Florida had come to see me while I was in prison, and they brought me all this AA material, you know, big book and all this stuff. And I shoved it under my bed where all that kind of stuff goes. And I pulled it out, but I didn't throw it away. And I pulled it out. And I started reading it. And I started going to meetings in prison. And I want to say, up until this point, I hadn't made a decision in prison not to use. There's drugs and booze and everything that you can imagine in prison. The only thing that kept me clean was the fact that there was never enough. I am a pig. And I don't want one of those. I don't want a half a pint. I want a gallon. Because when I'm going big. And I'm going to get locked up for it because I'm going in the hole, so I want to go drunk so I can at least sleep the first 4 days off. So, but there was just never enough. If I wasn't such a pig, I probably would have used in prison. So it's just one of those gifts that my higher powers bestowed on me. You know, I'm a glutton, so I was able to stay clean. So, and I mean that. So I started attending meetings in prison, and they're different. Meetings in a facility are not like meetings out on the street. It's kind of like a Bible revival in some ways, and it's just a little different. It's, you know what I mean? But I kept going because I knew that this was the only chance for me. I knew I couldn't go back to doing what I did. And I knew eventually I was going to get out, and I just kept plugging along. I was able finally to get the simple concepts that I had heard and read about, like one day at a time, one day at a time. I could never get one day at a time. I had my whole life in front of me, but I didn't have to go that far. I just had to deal with the here and the now. And eventually, I became eligible for parole in, after I'd served a certain amount of time. And after 10 and a half weeks, the state of New Jersey allowed me to be paroled. They allowed me to be paroled via the Interstate Compact to Florida, which was huge. I got to do my parole time with my family. I am still currently on parole. I will never forget when my brother picked me up at the airport. It was February 5th, 2007, and I'd served 6 years and 3 days. And I walked out of that prison with nothing except a jacket that said inmate, sweatpants, and a sweatshirt. And it was 10 below zero the day he picked me up. And he drove me to the airport, and he dropped me off, and I lit a cigarette, and I took my jacket that said inmate, and I stuffed it in a garbage can, and I walked inside the airport. And then I realized, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to check in for this flight. I've got this little packet of information, and God, I hope it's enough. I hope there's enough in here to let me on the plane. I don't know. Everything's different since 9/11, you know? There's all these security checkpoints, and I don't know what to do. It had been so long since I had been by myself, that I'd not been handcuffed, not been shackled, not been told where to go, not been told what to do, that I didn't have the ability to think for myself. And I remember waiting in this line, the security checkpoint line, and there was these two ladies in front of me, and I'm just so antsy because I'm quite sure they're going to think I'm bin Laden and not let me through, and I'm just panicking and panicking and panicking. And these ladies were just complaining. They had to take their shoes off to go through the metal detector. And me, I'm standing there thinking, the checkpoints I go through, I strip naked, bend over, and cough. Get out of my way, because I'm coming. You know what I mean? Step to the right, because I'll do it right here and right now. I don't care what it is. I want to go home. You know what I mean? So I got through. And then, of course, I ate at every fast food restaurant in Newark Airport. And I got on a plane. And I remember the feeling of seeing my sister for the first time as a free woman. It was a beautiful moment to be reunited with my family, to be free. But I didn't know how to live. I stayed with her, and I didn't know how to turn her television on. It's got three remote controls. Are you kidding me? I don't know how to turn it on. She used to have to turn it on in the morning for me and leave it because I didn't know how to turn it on. The only thing I knew, without exception, is that I had to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew if it was left up to me, I would become isolated, I would become hopeless and helpless, and then I will drink again. I also want to mention that one of the things that I was sentenced to was, upon release from incarceration, I lost my license for 15 years. So that started the day I came out of prison. So now I don't have a driver's license. I don't know how to live. I'm living with my sister, and I go about trying to find a job. Not very easy. But what I remember most is going into my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and walking through that door and being so scared to open that door, but knowing there was no other way, knowing that if I didn't get in there, that my life was over. I knew without exception that I had to have AA in my life. And as God would have it, when I opened that door, the first person I saw was my friend who came to see me when I was in prison, and it brought me the AA material. And that's God. I have a very hard time sharing in meetings. I don't like to share. I have a sponsor who has occasionally hit me and said, "Open your mouth." And that very first meeting, when they said, "Is anybody new or coming back?" It is so against who I am. I put my hand up and I said, "My name is Rose. I am an alcoholic and I just got out of prison." And I knew there was hope. I knew there was hope for me. There is nothing natural about this program for me. Everything about AA is about exactly opposite of how I live my life. Everything is a struggle for me. But the only thing I knew is that without meetings, I didn't have a chance, and I just kept going. I didn't know what to do except go to meetings. I tried to find a job. I kept going to meetings. I was told to get a temporary sponsor. I did that. I did that because I don't know how to live one day at a time without a drink. I don't. Then I was told to find a permanent sponsor, and that was one of the greatest dilemmas I've ever faced. I was so afraid. I didn't think anybody would want to be my sponsor. I am so damaged. I am such a piece of garbage. Why would anybody want to sponsor me? And I kept seeing this woman, and I kept listening to what she had to say, and I knew I wanted to ask her, but I was petrified. And eventually I did ask her, and she said this: "I was hoping you would ask." That's AA. And she made all these suggestions to me. One of the suggestions was that I needed to go to women's meetings. When you've been in prison for 6 years and 3 days, do you think you're looking for a women's meeting? I wasn't. But I went. I went because she knows how to live one day at a time with a drink, and I don't. And she started teaching me what it was like to trust somebody, because I don't know how to trust people. I don't know how to trust myself. I couldn't trust myself not to have a drink one day. How can I trust you? Every time I've trusted people, they've hurt me. So she taught me how to do that. I have such gratitude for the lessons that this woman has taught me in this program. I can't tell you enough about how much I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If anyone had ever told me that I would be someone who would get up in front of a room full of women and say, "I love AA," I would have said, "You have lost your mind." But here I am, and that's one of the benefits that this program has given me. I am grateful for so many things in my life today. I have a life that is beyond my wildest dreams. It is not the life I thought I'd have, but it is beyond my wildest dreams. Today I find I am most grateful for the things I don't get, for all those unanswered prayers, because my higher power knows better than I do. I am grateful for the ability to learn how to identify in a room and not compare. I was a big comparer, and not in a good way. I didn't say, "Well, I'm not that bad." I used to sit in meetings and listen to people and think, "She's drinking two glasses of wine and can't go to work. Walk it out." You know, I was drinking whiskey and I was all right. And I don't do that anymore. That's huge. I'm not joking. That's big. Everything I have today in my life that's good is because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything that I put before my sobriety, I will lose. And I know that because I keep dipping my toe in that water. Anytime I am uncomfortable or I am not feeling good, it's because there's a step I'm not working. And all of those lessons have been taught to me in this program by women. Who would have thought? always the last place you look. Everybody tells me if you don't remember your last drink, you're bound to drink again. I don't remember my last drink. It was really relatively uneventful. What I remember is the pain, and I don't have that today. I don't wake up and have that big black hole in my soul anymore. I don't wake up today and have to worry about what I did last night. I don't have to worry about who I hurt. I don't have to think about what I did. I just remember what I did. Everything that I have, from my job to the ride here, is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't begin to tell you how full my life is. I have a good life. It doesn't mean that I wake up every morning and I'm instantly grateful, because I'm not. Sometimes I have to get a lot of my gratitude from comparison. I'm glad I'm not her. I'm serious. Or I'm glad I didn't drink. But I have learned a couple of really simple lessons. I've learned that nothing has happened that a drink would have helped. Everybody says, you know, I'm afraid to go out and drink again because I'm going to die. I'm afraid if I go out and drink again, I'm going to live. That's my fear, is that I go back to the hell that was my life. Alcoholism brought me to my knees. It brought me to the gates of hell, and I couldn't stop drinking. But now I can, because I have tools, because I have friends that actually like me, and some of them really even love me. And I never thought that was possible. I've learned to love myself in this program. There was a time when I couldn't look at myself in the mirror, because I couldn't stand the woman looking back. And I can look at myself in the mirror today. I may not always like her, but I have hope for her. There's hope for her. This program allows me the opportunity to become the woman that God wants me to be. And that's what my hope is. Not a whole much, a whole lot has made sense in my life. This is the only thing that's ever made sense to me. The thing that finally got me and held me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is that your heart spoke to my heart. And that's what keeps me here. I can't tell you what it's like for me to be at a meeting and to hear that new person share and have them take me right back to that emotional place. I drank because I didn't know how to handle emotions. And now, because of this program, I can talk about what I used to drink about. And that's a miracle. I hope today, I've been given such an opportunity that you'll allow me to share something with you. There's something that was given to me right before I left prison out of this puppy program. One of the instructors handed me this little prayer by Mother Teresa. And it, to me, sums up everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to read it to you. It says, people are often unreasonable and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are honest, people may cheat you. Be honest anyway. If you find happiness, people may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today may be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. But give your best anyway. For you see, in the end, it's between you and God. It was never about them anyway. I really don't have anything else to say, except I can't tell you what an honor it has been to be allowed to share with you tonight. Thank you.